Hey guys, Ron Placone here. You're listening to the Indie Bohemians. It's that time again, huh? Let's start out with some housekeeping. So I know things have been up in the air, and some of you guys know why. I told you last week. It's because I'm now working at the Jimmy Dore Show full time. So that's kind of changed my wheelhouse a little bit. I will be in Minneapolis at the end of March. Unfortunately, I will only be doing the NACA conference, and then I'm leaving. I'm only sticking around for a day. Usually, when I go up to the Twin Cities, I like to perform. I like to do a lot of shows there. Actually, the Northern Plains, just for the record, is my favorite region for comedy. I love that area, Minneapolis, Wisconsin, even the Dakotas. And I don't mean that in a weird way, like, even the Dakotas. I just mean, like, you know, that's not... as cultural hubby as, you know, places like Madison, Eau Claire, Minneapolis. But the Dakotas got some really cool pockets, too. Even some parts of Iowa. Had a wonderful time in Sioux City. Had a wonderful time in Sioux Falls. It's my favorite region for comedy. It really is. Point is, usually when I go up there, I like to stay a while. I like to do some dates. This time around, that was not a possibility. I do apologize for that. But I promise I will get back up there. I know some of you guys have been tweeting at me, asking me when I was going to be doing shows there. And unfortunately, not happening this time around. But I will be back. I always head back up there. I almost moved to Minneapolis at one point. That's, not a lot of people know that because I don't really tell people. But I almost moved to Minneapolis at one point. Got a lot of love for that place. The winter scares the hell out of me. Main reason why I didn't move there. But I still love it. So, other tour dates, I will be out in the Midwest. April 12th, I'll be at Tots Place in Mentor, Ohio. April 14th, I will be at the Harrisburg Improv Theater in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. April 15th, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Got two shows going on, 8 p.m. at Unplanned Comedy. New venue in town. I'm looking forward to checking it out. 10 p.m. at Ham Bones. And you guys, Pittsburgh folks, you know that Ham Bones is an old staple of mine. I love that place. Still my favorite room in the city. And I'll be rocking at Ham Bones at 10 p.m. Derek Minto's going to be on that show. You guys remember him from this show. All those Midwest shows are with my good buddy Patrick Cunningham, a fantastic comic out of Huntsville, Alabama. We are embarking on a comedy tour called Morrissey's Favorite Bacon. It's called that for no reason other than we just find it humorous. And there's got to be a couple other music geeks that also find it humorous. Speaking of humorous things that only music geeks will find appealing, I live with a dog named Bikini. To close off housekeeping, right, romplacone.com for all the latest updates. For all the Jimmy Dore folks, keep checking out the YouTube. We got a lot of stuff coming up this week. A lot is always going on there. Anybody that was at the Flappers show this past Monday, the live Jimmy Dore show at Flappers, thanks for coming out. Thanks for hanging out. It was really cool to meet everybody. And, drop me a line. I was serious when I said, hey, email me and keep in touch. Please do that. I'd really appreciate it if you did that. And it was wonderful to see everybody at Flappers. Special shout out to Jeffrey from Austin, who made those amazing Jimmy Dore t-shirts for all of us. I love mine. I've already worn it a couple times. So Jeffrey, thanks for that. And I hope we get a live show in Austin for you really soon. So, moving on. I live with a dog named Bikini. And this morning, it dawned on me. I just said, you know, Bikini... Her name's Bikini. She's a dog. If she ever hunted anything, we could call it a Bikini Kill. Huh? That's a pun that relates to the Riot Girl movement. How I tweeted that, and a couple people liked it. I posted it on Facebook. Some people liked it. Not many. I told it to my roommate. She had no idea what I was talking about. She was like, "What is that like? Is that a dating thing? What does that mean?" And I explained to her that Bikini Kill was a band. Part of the Riot Girl movement. My roommate did not grow up in America. She grew up in Italy, which is cool because we speak Italian to each other. She's fluent. I'm not fluent, but I'm conversational. But we have a fun Italian-speaking household. But she was not familiar. She's familiar with a lot of stuff. You know, she was still plugged into American culture a good bit. But she was not hip to the Riot Girl thing when it happened. So I explained it to her. Which made it even less funny than it was initially. But I found it fascinating, and, you know, when you run a show, called where the slogan is Punks, Puns, and Politics. Punk, Puns, and Politics. Can't even say it. That's something fun you got to throw out there. You got to throw out your Riot Girl pun when you got it. I'm excited about the guest today. My guest today is Jim Valley. I mispronounce his name all the time. I don't know why. But he's a great TV writer. He has written for Arrested Development. He's written for Golden Girls. We get a little insider baseball here. We get a little talking about the TV writing world, some of the mechanics about it. He throws some tips in there. So for all you guys that are comedians or writers, I know there's some creative types that listen to this show. This is your kind of episode. Not really a music-focused show, but, you know, I threw my Riot Girl... my Riot Girl thing in there, and it's a fun conversation, and I kind of tricked him into being on the show. Some of you guys remember last week, Maggie Rowe, the author, was our guest. Maggie is Jim's wife. I recorded the episode at her house, so I had my stuff set up, and I just said, hey, all this stuff is still set up, Jim's hanging out in the other room. Does he want to sit down for a few minutes? And Jim's a little shy about doing interviews. He's not a big fan of it. And I said, look, Jim, no pressure. If you want to do it, I'd love to have you. If you don't, it's okay. I know we've talked about it before. I've been wanting to have you for a long time. And, I don't know if there's going to be a more opportune time. I'm sitting here with my microphones all set up, my laptop all set up, my audio software ready to go. And you're right here in front of me and I'm in your kitchen. I don't know if we're going to get a more ideal time. But, you know, and he's like, well, I'll give you 10 minutes. We talked for a lot longer than 10 minutes, but I just didn't say anything. I just let him keep going. That's how you do it. And Jim's been in the industry a long time. You know, one time we were out for coffee, and we're sitting there, we're having coffee. This guy spots him, and he goes, oh, hey, Jim, man, it's so good to see you. So good to, see you. How's everything going? What do you got going on? What projects? He's like, we're going to do, we're still working on Arrested. He was referring to Arrested Development, of course. Guy's like, oh, that's so neat. You know, I'd love a bit part, whatever. You know, and they're laughing, joking around, like, oh, this guy's going to do a bit part. And I'm like half listening. I just assumed it was like some actor that maybe knew Jim, right? Oh, this is an actor, recognizes Jim. And maybe it's an actor that has not had work in a while. That is thinking, well, maybe I can, maybe I really will score that bit part in Arrested Development. I'm going to call my SIGO when I get home, said, hey, I ran into a pretty successful writer. Maybe I'm going to get bit part on a TV show. That's what I'm thinking might be going through this guy's head. This unnamed, seemed a little like older-ish, maybe like a middle-aged-ish dude talking to Jim while we're having coffee. Then the gentleman took off his disguise. Yes, he was wearing a disguise. Why was he wearing a disguise, Ron? Because he was Bob Odenkirk. There was a moment where I was like, I recognize this guy's voice. Then he took off his glasses and his hat, and it was Bob Odenkirk. I was like, that is definitely not an actor that's looking for work. That's an actor that was totally just joking around when he said, I'd love a bit part, or... you're really going to have to work on his schedule if you actually want him to do that bit part. He's Bob Odenkirk. He's got Better Call Saul going on, which, by the way, comes back soon, and I am excited about it. I think I saw something online. Comes back at some point in April. I think early April, so I'm stoked for that. Game of Thrones comes back, too. So I don't know. I'm looking forward to both of those things, and I will spend more time following television shows. I have not had that as of recent, which means I've been following other things that have more drama than Game of Thrones, like this Supreme Court nominee and the fact that the Democrats are going to do nothing about resisting this dude. They're going to do nothing. He's just going to kind of skate in. Meanwhile, we're still just talking about Russia. We're still talking nonstop about Russia. Well, this is happening. Well, the not a president, Trump, because he's not a president. I explained that. He's not a president, but he has bills that would end unions as we know it, that are going to gut education, that are going to destroy the environment. All those bills are out there, and we're not talking about any of that stuff. Instead, we're talking about outrageous stuff he's saying on Twitter, the way he's antagonizing North Korea now. and some of the verbiage about the North Korea paranoia, it mirrors something that happened in the past. You know what that something in the past was? Iraq. Remember Iraq? And that goes back to a theme that I've been harping on. Donald Trump is the best recruitment tool the left has seen in 20 years. You know why I'm a huge lefty? Because of Iraq. Because of the Bush administration. Because friends of mine were going off to fight that war, and I had no idea why we were over there. And I found out we were over there because of lies. Because of deception. Because of oil. Because of this new American century wet dream brought forward by a bunch of plutocrat billionaires who only had profits in mind and don't mind sending other poor people over to die for their cause. I learned that. And I don't know when I would have learned that otherwise. Donald Trump is an amazing recruitment tool for the left, and we're seeing some of the effects of that, but we're not seeing the full effects of it. You know why? Because the Democrats don't really give anyone leadership to latch onto, do they? They've been playing it the company way through and through. And I know that, you know, especially some of you Jimmy Dore fans, I'm preaching to the choir here. But when they're going to do nothing to resist a Supreme Court nominee, they're not going to try to filibuster. They're not going to resist. They're asking some tough questions. Allegedly. They're asking tough questions in the hearings. This guy's still going to skate through. Because if they did filibuster him, they'd be scared the Republicans were going to change the rule anyway. So they're just going to roll over on this one. Instead of forcing the Republicans to make an unpopular decision and then have them answer to the people, which would then have them give them a better opportunity to have a Democratic bloodbath in 2018. They're just going to roll over and play dead now. Why? Because we don't want to make the right mad. We want to be more like the right. That's the strategy the Democrats are employing. It is a losing strategy. And that's all it is. Stop making excuses for them. Stop making excuses for them. Even if you've been in bed with the Democrats so far, they just turned and spit on you. Whether you're the biggest Hillary supporter in the world, whether you like Tom Perez, which if you do, I have no idea why, unless you're a Republican. But even if you do, they just turn their back on you. Because the one thing you wanted was for them to resist this Supreme Court. And guess what? They're not gonna. They ain't gonna. Instead of backing the Republicans in the corner, make them do something unpopular. They're not going to do it. They're not going to do it. So anyway, I'm looking forward to having to pay attention to more things like Better Call Saul and Game of Thrones. Which, it's weird that we live in a system that is more corrupt than Game of Thrones. Did you ever think about that? And it's too bad we don't have a just leader that has three dragons. They could diplomatically enforce peaceful solutions. Maybe. I don't know. I don't know what would happen if somebody... That'd be crazy. If, like, who would you give the three dragons to? I'd give them to Noam Chomsky. That's what I would do. I'd be like, he's in charge now. He has three dragons. And he kind of looks like a wizard. So it wouldn't be that weird for him to have three dragons. I don't think. All right. Now we're getting all over the place. Gotta wrap up this preamble. But anyway, to close out this story with me, and I participated in the conversation. I didn't want to I did make sure I shook Bob Odenkirk's hand. I just introduced myself, said, "Hey, I'm Ron, by the way, friend of Jim's." He said, "Oh, hey, I'm Bob." And then after he left, I guess I did a good enough job playing it cool because Jim turned to me and he's like, "You know who that was, right?" And I was like, "Yeah, I know who that was. That's really neat." And I'm a huge fan of that show, but, yeah, I didn't want to be weird. I didn't want to draw attention. So anyway, that's who Jim Vallehy is. And we get a peek under the hood, what his thoughts are on writing. We get to hear his life story. It's a really fun conversation. Went on longer than 10 minutes. Cause you know what? He was having a good time. He was having a good time. I'm Ron Placone. You're listening to the Indie Bohemians.
Here's your Monkey Minute. I am Angie Doran for the Indie Bohemians. The fate of Bella, a Patis monkey, remains in limbo after it was taken from a Laconia, New Hampshire home where it was being kept illegally as a family pet. The monkey is in witness protection, said veterinarian Dr. Michael Dutton, who owns and operates the Weir Animal Hospital, where the monkey was examined. The rehabilitator now caring for Bella is a volunteer and is keeping the location a secret. Ooh. To prevent media attention, while fish and game officials find a forever home for Bella, possibly in a zoo or sanctuary. That's the Monkey Minute. I am Angie Doran for the Indie Bohemians.
Ron Flacone here. You are listening to the Indie Bohemians, and my guest this week, I just tricked this guy into doing my show. That's where...
I was tricked.
That's where we're at. Convinced him. I've been wanting to have you for a long time, Jim.
Oh, that's kind of flirty, don't you think?
A little bit.
Hi. Hi, Ron.
Jim Vallehi, a legendary writer. You've been doing your thing for a long time.
What have you heard? Yeah, I've been doing it a long time. That is true. I've been a television writer since 1985, so that's pretty long, right?
Uh-huh.
And you say, yeah, sure.
And quite a resume, Arrested Development.
That's right.
Many others.
That's right.
And, dude, you have the coolest story that hasn't been told. You're a living Bruce Springsteen song.
Wait, what do you mean the coolest story? I have a cool story?
Of course. Well, you got a bunch of cool stories, or you wouldn't have the job that you have.
All right.
You're being very modest.
Sure. Who likes a braggart? Who wants a guy who comes on the radio and brags all the time?
Not I. I'm set you up for that.
All right.
I'm just saying this guy's got some cool stuff, and we're gonna dive into it. And you're like, wow.
All right. I'll see what I can remember.
No, you grew up in Jersey.
New Jersey, yes.
And you had an experience with a girl named Sandy.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
Well, let's skip over that.
But I'm just saying, you're a Springsteen song.
I am a Springsteen song, but I mean, in 1972, I was the year I graduated high school,
mm-hmm.
and it was a different time. Obviously, all times are different times, but it was in 1972. Everyone smoked pot around, mm-hmm. but this was just when Nixon was running. It was the big election in 72. And I only found this out recently, that Nixon really was started the war on drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And because he was such a paranoid, sort of nutty guy, one of the things he did was he started the war on drugs the summer of 72, because it was also the first presidential election that 18-year-olds were allowed to vote.
I didn't realize that.
Believe it or not, one of the reasons there was a lot of riots in the 60s was you had to be 21 to vote,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of guys were being drafted and going to Vietnam and dying, and they didn't think that was fair. So the rallying cry was old enough to die, or old enough to fight, old enough to vote.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, old enough to get a drink, too, in my humble opinion.
That's right, but, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But really, when you think about the idea of not being able to vote, but you were still drafted, and it's also the reason why there were a lot more colleges in the mid-60s, because one of the ways to get deferred from the vote is if you went to college. You know, kids didn't go to college, you know, in the 40s and 50s. You know, that was like a rich kid thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, regular kids, you know, you learned to become a plumber or something like that, and, you know, you got a job. So all of in the 60s, all of a sudden, there were these guys in the mid-60s who never would have gone to college. All of a sudden, colleges were swarming. They were growing all over the place. That's why you see all these county colleges that were basically, you know, agricultural schools and whatnot. All of a sudden, they became real colleges. Kids were just trying to get out of the draft.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So anyway, in 72, they were trying to mess up the thing, and they started the war on drugs, and I got caught in the war on drugs. Now, I wasn't like a hippie kid or anything like that. I was just like a regular kid. But they infiltrated. We had a little boardwalk in New Jersey that we all lived on over mm-hmm. the summer. And it was the first time there was like a narc.
Mm-hmm.
And they had like a couple of narcs working the boardwalk. and they got a friend of mine. They asked me, you know, if I could get pot, and everyone knew someone who sold pot, and I knew someone who sold pot, and I ended up getting arrested. And that was a big deal back in 1972 to get arrested. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of the thing that sort of derailed me from being like a normal, loving, hardworking member of society to realizing, oh, geez, you can get really hurt out here. Now, what I did was wrong, but ultimately we went to court and all the cases were thrown out because it was the beginning of the entrapment deal. Mm-hmm. You know, they just said, you know, you can't entrap somebody into committing a crime and then arrest them for that. Brilliant. So, yeah, that was the beginning of that chapter in my life. And I ended up going to NYU, you know, a year or two later. And that's where I got into writing comedy. That's where I got into the comedy world.
Do you think those experiences are related?
Like, absolutely.
Like that
absolutely.
Kind of, you got this, like, yeah. Slap from the real world.
Well, it was more than a slap, but I really did think, you know, this is the end of my life. You know, so I might as well try to do something that I like doing. I really did think it was the end of my life. Because back then, you know, you were looking at real time.
Mm-hmm.
You still are. It's still.
Oh, yeah.
It's absolutely absurd how many people, mostly people of color, men of color, who are in jail because of basically selling a weed. You know,
yep.
Did, have you seen the documentary 13th?
Yes.
Yes, yes. I think everybody out in Radioland should watch 13th. It's really, it's like, there's nothing in it that I didn't know, but I certainly put a narrative to it that I especially think white people have to, you know, wake up and see the narrative of white history versus the narrative of African American history are very, very different in this country. We should,
yeah.
You know,
oh, absolutely.
Have a little empathy. Mm-hmm. Empathy, don't you think?
All right, hey,
yeah. What kind of radio are we on? Are we on like what kind of radio are we on?
We're on
like, who's listening to this? Who are
right
you?
Right now, just me and you.
Oh, I know
right
that.
Now, it's just
yeah.
us. We're pre-recording.
Yeah, I'm in my kitchen. I'm not a fool.
A lot of lefties. Because I'm on a lot of progressive, pretty much all of our terrestrial.
Hey, lefties.
Are progressive.
Everything's fine in our little Hollywood bubble here. Come
yeah,
on
right.
out.
Come on out. But, and I only have one affiliate in California. So,
oh, really?
So
who's
are,
that? Oh,
are,
good. Oh, okay. I can talk freely.
Yeah. Camps Media. And they're up in, I think, Santa Barbara area. So
oh,
not,
beautiful up
yeah,
there.
Yeah.
So there's probably some attractive young liberal person driving down. Through,
that just has this on.
Yeah.
Has this on in the background as we're recording, but yeah, they'll have it on, and weeks from now we might get, hey, a listener tweeted.
Who's this guy, Jim? Valerie. What is it? Who writes for Arrested Development? Ah, yes. And Golden Girls, too. I used to write, Golden Girls was my first big show, The Golden Girls.
Mm-hmm. So you go to NYU. What did you study?
I studied acting, but mm-hmm. I was a terrible actor. Studied with the great Stella Adler. Anybody who knows anything about acting, like, you know, she was one of the great acting teachers of all time. But I was a terrible actor. But back then, you didn't know you were a terrible actor because you just went through, you know, feedback that you got from your friends and relatives. And, oh, you were so great as Rodolfo in A View from the Bridge.
But did you do, like, just theater stuff?
Yeah, you just did theater stuff. Well, you know.
Were you a musical guy, too?
I can barely pick up a tune. But,
okay.
You know, you had to do a little bit of everything.
Right.
Back then, you know. And it was exciting to live in Manhattan. I lived in, I got married very young, and I had a daughter in 75.
Mm-hmm.
And we moved into a building in Manhattan. It was a HUD building called Manhattan Plaza, which was a building that you got for performing artists. It was right smack in the middle of Hell's Kitchen. And this is in the late 70s. And New York was really a horrible, horrible. There was so much crime. And, you know, everyone had moved to the suburbs. And no one who had any money wanted to live there. So I got really lucky. It was still hard to get an apartment, of course, but we got a brand new building, and it was like the projects, except instead of just being poor, you had to be, you had to make your living from being a writer, actor, producer, anything to do with the arts. And down the hall from me, there was a guy, named Kramer, who was a comedian, and across the hall from Kramer moved Larry David. And so this is like 1978, and, you know, we were all living, basically we were paying about $150 a month rent, which even for back then wasn't much. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, I got to actually see Larry, and I would follow him like a little puppy dog to the improv and watch him perform. And, you know, so, you know, and, but I
so it was like a creative commune.
Almost. Oh, it was a total creative commune. I mean, Samuel Jackson was our security guard.
Wow.
Yeah, Angela Lansbury lived in the building. Tennessee Williams lived in the building. Oh, yeah. Jeez. It's still there. I mean, it still flourishes.
Do they still do that? Is that still
there? Yeah, they still, yeah.
It's a creative?
You know, you have to pay, you know, you only paid one-third your gross income.
Okay.
One-third or one-fourth your gross income. So it's still there, and it's, you know, it's, to me, it's a great example of how socialism could work, mm-hmm. you know, because we would not have Seinfeld. Larry David, you know, I think if you asked him, he probably, if he could not have lived in Manhattan for those couple of years, he probably would have, you know, quit. You know, Larry David would be the funny guy at Radio Shack. So, what kind of bed are you looking for, AA? That's what we would have had. But, and how many, you know, millions of dollars in taxes has Larry paid since then, you know?
Right, yeah.
And almost everybody, once they got their footing, in the building, you know, they're all paying full market rent, so mm-hmm. you know, that was a great experience. Yeah,
making genius.
Yeah, making genius.
So, when did you start in the business in New York then, or did you head out here?
No, New York. I started in New York. Yeah, yeah. Went to NYU, and then
step around a while.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Why would you leave New York? But I wasn't a good actor. That was my problem. Mm-hmm. I wasn't a good actor. But I began doing stand up comedy. I got one of the other guys I went to NYU with, a guy named Jonathan Schmock. And Jonathan and I, Jonathan is best known for, if you've ever seen Ferris Bueller's Day Off, mm-hmm. Jonathan plays the maitre d' at restaurant. You're Froman, the Sausage King of Chicago. Uh-huh. And that's Jonathan, that's my comedy partner. But he's a really good actor, he always works. And we began doing this little act, and then one day we got a really nice review in the Daily News, and somebody saw that, and a guy named Warren Littlefield, who used to run NBC, saw us, and he flew us out to New York City. I mean, he flew us out from New York to Los Angeles, and we auditioned at the Comedy Store for Brandon Tartikoff, who ran NBC. This is like 83, 84. And the other act that we auditioned with was Jim Carrey.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah, Jim was like 19. So, and we both got deals. And actually, it was a rough night at the Comedy Store, because we had to perform. They didn't know that we were going on. The owner did not know that Brandon Tartikoff was coming in. It's called a showcase, you know, to see us, a showcase for him. And Richard Pryor was going on a lot in the small room, in the original room. And so the original room holds 150 people. So it's a good ticket to get to see Richard Pryor work out his act.
Yeah.
But we're performing there, and Richard Pryor is sitting in the back. Richard Pryor had given Tartikoff, you know, or whoever, you know, those guys can go on ahead of me. Mm-hmm. And after our acts, and, you know, it was a rough crowd, because they would look at us, and then they turned back to see Richard Pryor's reaction to us.
Man.
You know, it's like
split focus. He's not laughing.
Richard Pryor, who I had never met before or since, went on stage and basically said to Brandon Tartikoff that, you know, he used a racial epithet about himself, but he said, no guy like this should have to follow those acts. And Jim Carrey and us got nice big fat deals at NBC the next day. He was really complimentary to us. Yeah.
That is the ultimate compliment for any comic. Richard Pryor said it was rough following you.
Yeah.
Richard Pryor said that.
So we all got deals, and then I realized, after I saw myself on television for the first time, that I had just chosen the wrong profession.
In what way?
I'm not a good actor.
Okay.
This is the thing. I mean, I'm an okay actor.
What was your first television appearance then?
We had done stand up. We did the Tonight Show and all that jazz. But we did One Day at a Time, the very last episode that they shot of One Day at a Time.
Mm-hmm.
Not the last one they aired, the last one that they shot. They didn't, you know, shoot them in order. And it was a pretty big part. And back then, it was like there were three networks. So if you were on television, it was like a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at myself, and I was just humiliated. I was like, boy, can that guy not act? But I stuck with it. And and then they gave us a TV series after that for about a year or two. And my partner, really good actor. It must have been so aggravating for him to, you know, have to carry me around. But I was a pretty good writer. And after a little while, I got a job offer from a guy who I had, you know, been on a show as an actor. And his name was Don Rio. And he got me into a company called Whit Thomas, which is right up the street from where I live now,
mm-hmm.
off in Cahuenga, and they were doing Golden Girls. And that's really when my career started, when they hired me to write on Golden Girls.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I met, like, Mitch Hurwitz, who would go on to create Arrested Development, and he and I have worked together on probably about 10 TV series together since Golden Girls.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we worked on the John Larroquette show together, and you know, Mitch had Mitch is a genius. I'm a hack, but hey, I'm just saying it as I see it. that's basically, you know, that's my whole life story. So I guess if there's anything to learn from that is sell drugs, get exonerated by a really good lawyer, go into a profession that you're not good at. When you succeed in that profession and you realize how bad you are in that profession, go to another profession. And that is how you have a successful career.
That is brilliant.
Thank you.
So, so I guess from a practical standpoint, because I know we have some, like, some comics and stuff that listen. What would you say? How has the world of TV writing changed? What are
It's gotten really, really much. The quality of writing has gone up. Like, I'm not one of those guys, oh, in the old days, you know. It's just gotten much better, and it's much more real, and, you know, there are shows that could never have been done 30, 20 years ago, and that are being done now. I'm blown away by shows like Atlanta, and I'm blown away by, you know, Crashing now. I mean, there's some real, you know, and forget the 1 hour. The 1 hour stuff has gotten amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Amazingly well. And then, you know, like what we did back in the 80s, it's not a lot of great television back in the 80s, really, when you think about it. I was lucky because I got to do one of the good shows, which was Golden Girls, which is a classic, and it's a nice, warm show. Everyone likes it. Your grandma likes it. Your sisters like it. My daughter likes it. You know, everyone likes that show. It's a warm show, and I don't think that they have those kind of shows as much anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Shows that are just kind of comfort food, you know. It's like, okay. You know, the show's like Cheesecake, you know, and really funny, and laugh-out-loud funny. But it's laugh-out-loud funny because we have these four old broads, you know, basically doing penis jokes,
right.
if you will. Then around the 90s, things got better, and Seinfeld changed everything, of course. And but now I just think we're living in a golden age. I just think there's, one of the differences, like on Golden Girls, we would do 30 a year, mm-hmm. and now they do maybe 10 or 12 of the shows, like for Netflix and whatnot, you do 10 right. and whatnot. That's different. You know, the studio audience thing is kind of, it's like the same show over and over. It's the same sort of joke that you have to do over and over, and I'm not knocking it. It's still the best job in the business to get on a four-camera show with a studio audience.
Mm-hmm. But, why is that?
It's just fun. Mm-hmm. It's just fun, you know? It's like you get to do a different play every week. It's like being in summer stock.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
You know? And you just know that, okay, it's going to be over no matter what. We're going to shoot this thing on Friday night, and then we'll chop it up, and we'll throw some laughs in it. And throw some laughs over it in most cases. And, you know, it'll be fine.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, you see a lot of people out here where it's like they get overwhelmed when they're sitting in a room, or they get overwhelmed when they have to look for their next gig.
Yeah.
Or they you know, do it right. They learn the game and they excel. What would you say is kind of the key to longevity for somebody that wants to write?
I don't know. I mean, you know, what
something worked for
you. What I always just did is, you know, I had a couple of people, a guy named Don Rio, who would hire me a lot, and a guy named Mitch Hurwitz, who would hire me a lot, and I would work. You work hard. You just try to, you know, it's like one joke at a time, or one line at a time, the room. You know, I've seen people. I guess the big mistake that a lot of guys make is they'll want to be the showrunner right away.
Okay.
And it's a totally different talent, you know. Mm-hmm. And once in a while, you get guys who like turn down gigs because they don't think the show is good, and it's like, yeah, none of them are really that good, guys. So take the gig, you know. Take those little in between. Nobody really thinks about your career as much as you do. Mm-hmm. So, you know, don't worry about it. But I mean, I would take shows and people would say, oh, I can't believe you're doing that show. And it's like, you know, yeah, no, you do those shows. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to, you know, name shows. But, you know, there's like, you know, especially like after Arrested, people thought, oh, you know, you're only going to be doing shows as good as like Arrested. Well, there aren't that many shows that are that good as Arrested. Yeah. And, you know, if you're going to keep on looking for that thing, you're going to fail. You're not going to find it. And also, it's fun. It's fun to, you know, it's fun. I always get jobs, like, putting shows into the grave. Like, I got, you know, shows into their last season. Mm-hmm. You know, those are the most fun shows to write
just
for.
Just like you got nothing.
Yeah,
to lose.
Yeah, yeah. You know, yeah, you're not looking at the ratings. Books. Yeah. Okay. It's just like, yeah, we're dead. You know, dead show walking. Let's go. Let's put it in. and they're the most fun. I remember I worked with Brad Garrett. You know, to work with Brad Garrett, Brad Garrett's really good. You know, mm-hmm. really good comic. And he's a really, one of the better sitcom actors, you know, I think I've ever gotten to work with. But, you know, we were on a show, and, you know, I think it was like his fifth or sixth or seventh season of a show called Till Death that he did. Mm-hmm. And we had so much fun with that show because he was like, yeah, let's play with it. Let's just do things, you know, that we, you know, we couldn't do. And we broke the wall a lot and just messed around with it because we knew the show really, you know, it was not going to go further. And so we experimented with that. We experimented too with when John Larroquette had a show, and we were in the last season of that. Mitch Hurwitz was like, "Hey, let's mess with the thing." So you get to do those sort of things when you're on a show that is definitely going to be canceled. You know, the networks and the studios just kind of like look away. Eh, they don't care. They're always involved with their new shows. That's the new girlfriend.
Yeah.
Or boyfriend for you ladies and gay men out there listening in your liberal cars. Hurry up, there's a socket. Go and charge your car up real quick. Got another 40 miles to go.
Jim, thanks so much for doing this, man. That's all I'm doing.
All right. Okay, well, now you have me. Now leave me alone.
All right. Got it done.
Bye. Thanks a lot, Jim. Like, I'm shaking his hand. You can't hear it over the thing. I swear to God, I'm shaking his hand. All right. Love you. Mean it.